ultimately, ASE wants to not just attract, but also retain and nurture talent. And if the people that we're attracting are having a really bad experience when they're going through their recruitment process, they're going to leave the movement and they're never going to come back again. We spend a lot of money on attracting people in, so we want the organizations to look after them and like give them a good experience.
Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement. A very comprehensive episode this week on all things employment in the animal advocacy movement as we speak with Lauren May, co-founder and CEO of Animal Advocacy Careers. We deep dive into bottlenecks, challenges in hiring, and some interesting survey feedback that has informed Lauren on why talented and passionate people might find coming into this movement more difficult than other opportunities available to them. I learned loads in this episode, and I think whether you're not yet in the movement, a manager looking to hire, a mid-level employee looking to advance into something more senior, there's really something for everyone. There's also tons of resources in the show notes that I recommend checking out, as well as the ever-important work of Animal Advocacy Careers website, which offers resources, trainings, and the one-to-one career advising service. Also, did you know that transcripts are now available via our website, howilearntolovesshrimp.com? If you do find it easier or more useful to read through the episode, they are now available. You can also use the chapter markers to skip through if you find certain sections more useful or you want to refer back to a specific section at a later date. And lastly, as Steen spoke about in a past episode, applications for the movement grants that animal charity evaluators offer are now live and available to apply to, which we would encourage anyone looking for funding to do. You can find out more at their website, animalcharityevaluators.org. We're joined today by Lauren May, CEO and co-founder of Animal Advocacy Careers, an organisation that tries to match mission-aligned talent to opportunities that accelerate the end of factory farming. Prior to Animal Advocacy Careers, Lauren worked as a consultant. She's also a mentor for Magnify Mentoring, a strategic advisor to Talist, the AVA Summit, and is on the board of EACN and the Mission Motor. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
What is EACN the acronym for?
That's for the Effective Altruism Consulting Network. So I think they're actually going to rebrand at some point, but at the moment that is what it stands for.
Great job. So many mentoring and strategic advisor positions. clearly a good use of your previous consultancy role in the movement, which is great to see.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I do try. I mean, I think that everyone has a limited amount of time, and it's always a trade-off between like how much you're actually going to spend on your job versus other things. But I started off in the movement doing volunteering, and I still feel like it's a really important part of how I contribute to the movement. So I do want to keep that up.
Okay. I'd like to know from you, who is someone in the movement that people might not know about that you find particularly inspiring?
So it's a good question, and it's really hard because I think that our movement is genuinely filled with so many inspiring people. And you really notice that at conferences where you're just like, wow, so many people are doing great things. But maybe someone that not everyone knows, but I think both of you at least know, is Leila Kazam from Animal Think Tank. And I just find her genuinely extremely inspiring. From the way that she speaks about like social movement ecology, and from just the way that she's not just focused on what many organizations are focused on, which is like, how did their organization do what they're set out to do? It's much more broad. How are we actually going to end factory farming? How are we going to liberate animals? And not many people talk about that. And I find it really inspiring. And I really enjoy the conversations that I have with her whenever I'm lucky enough to speak with Leila or hear her talk. So I really, if people don't know her, then I think look her up, speak to her, and hopefully they'll get inspired too.
There's a great talk by Leila online, I think from previous conferences, so we'll maybe link one of those if you want to see one of the rousing speeches and also explanations of social movement ecology that you mentioned, Lauren. So we'll definitely link that for folks who are interested. But yeah, Lauren, so we want to get into a big topic in the movement, which is about jobs, how to have a big impact with your career, all that kind of stuff. But I guess before we get into that, I'm kind of curious to hear about you and your journey into co-founding Animal Advocacy Careers.
Ironically, I think I'm kind of the living embodiment of what AAC tries to do. So I started in the for-profit sector, and I built up a lot of skills. And I think then I made the or tried to make the transition from the for-profit sector into the non-profit sector. And it took me about 2 or 3 years to do it. So I also really heavily can relate to people who are out there job seeking, and they're trying to, you know, really make their mark and enter into the movement. And it isn't really straightforward. And I think that that's a really common thing that people think, oh, there's skill bottlenecks in the animal advocacy movement, so I should just be able to get a job. And that's not really how it works. And so for me, I think I got involved in animal advocacy in around 2016, and I started with street activism. And then I think at some point, somebody suggested to me, who was giving me career advice, said, hey, Lauren, I think the skills you have could actually be really useful to the animal advocacy movement. So then I started doing skilled volunteering for the Good Food Institute and the Humane League alongside my regular job. And I just really enjoyed it. I was like, I loved my job. I genuinely did, but I thought this is way better. And then there was a difficult trade-off in terms of me being conscientious and trying to do my job well, but also wanting to do a lot for animals. So it really was the pushing factor for me to think, okay, I would really like to do this full time. And then, yeah, as I said, it took like maybe 2 or 3 years of me applying to different roles until the charity entrepreneurship opportunity came up. And I thought, I'll apply. I probably won't get in because I just didn't think I would be a founder. I just thought there's no chance. So it's fine for me to apply because it seems like a crazy program, and who wants to quit their job to like start a charity? But there was also no previous success record. So they only had 45 health. So I was also on the first cohort, and it was such a high risk career opportunity.
That's quite a big leap of faith. I mean, even doing it several years in felt like a leap of faith, but being the first cohort, that seems particularly out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had my backup plan in. So I made sure that, you know, as I applied, I told my boss that I was doing it. And I was like, if it doesn't work out, can I come back? And he was like, of course, Lauren. And he was like, you're probably going to be back. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. But it did work out. And I did co-found Animal Advocacy Careers. And yeah, I think it was one of the best decisions I made. I think I've learned more in this 4 years of running an organization than I did for most of the rest of my career. So I definitely don't regret it, but it certainly wasn't easy. And I really, as I said, I really can relate to a lot of people who are doing the job searching at the moment.
Did you already know of Animal Advocacy Careers as a concept? Was that already one of the ideas from charity entrepreneurship? So you knew specifically you were going in to apply for that, or were you kind of open to right across different cause areas, or was it always animal? Like, what did that look like?
So I think I actually really wanted to start Fish Welfare Initiative. That was my, I wanted to do that.
I see.
Yeah, I did. And I think, yes, I went onto the program wanting to either do a direct animal advocacy kind of charity, or mental health. I was also really interested in mental health. And then the charity entrepreneurship just decided. I remember so vividly going into Joey's office, and he was like, you are doing animal advocacy careers. And I was like, what? And he was like, you're the best one for it on this program. I think that your skills are really aligned with it. And I was like, but I really want to do the Fish Welfare Initiative. He's like, no, Lauren, this is the one for you. And so I don't think I was even super passionate about animal advocacy careers. But as you know, as you get more into it and you learn more about the problem and you realize how big it is, then I think you become like much more like into it. And now I can't imagine starting any other charity, but it was certainly not the one that I came into with the idea of starting animal advocacy careers. I really wanted to do Fish Welfare Initiative.
I can still sense the bitterness. Avon and Tom are doing a great job. You're doing a great job. Hopefully animals are getting good things, well, from you guys. So I think all's good. But actually, I think there's like an interesting, almost like life lesson in there that I'm curious to get your thoughts. It's like, you kind of didn't end up doing what was really the most exciting for you or felt like your biggest passion, but something that you end up loving over time. And do you think that's something that is like actually surprisingly quite possible, that you can enter a job you don't feel super excited about, but you tend to love it? Or you think you should really only go for stuff you love from the outset?
Yeah. I mean, this is the traditional career advice versus like what actual psychology tells you is good for your job. And yeah, I think like there's so many books on this, and 80,000 hours also speak a lot about it, that actually the thing that makes job satisfaction and actually makes you like have an enjoyable job is doing something that you're good at and you enjoy. So that's slightly different to passion. And I think that this was kind of where like Joey kind of was like, you're good at this, you will be good at this. And he could see this kind of like, he matchmade me basically to the opportunity and was like, I think that you will really excel in this area. I enjoyed it and I enjoy it more the more that I realize that I'm kind of good at it. And I think that those kind of things just kind of trickle over. But I think that you have to at least have some enjoyment out of it. Otherwise, I mean, you don't want to just do a job because you're good at it if you're not getting any enjoyment, because then you'll end up leaving that job pretty soon afterwards as well.
Yeah, seems like a really necessary hybrid. And we've recently had an episode with Aaron Ross about longevity. And I think that's a really important way to make sure and ensure that people stay around for the long haul, is that, you know, they're passionate about their job and that they want to go to work to support their own position in the movement and obviously support the animals. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. Do you think then that that was specific to Joey identifying that match for you? Because I think sometimes people find it difficult to know what their skill set is actually good for. Obviously, you had a great opportunity there to get advice from Joey, and you know, he really saw that future for you. Is it easy enough to self-identify in that way, do you think?
I think some people do look to other people to nudge them. And I often get it in career advising. They're like, Lauren, what should I do?
Just tell me. Yeah, yeah.
I can't really make that decision for them. But I actually think that one of the best ways to work that out is by trying different things. And again, this is career advice, general career advice for people, that when you are starting off, like specifically after you've just graduated, that it's really good idea to try different things. Because very often the first thing that you think of is not going to be the thing that you actually end up being the best at. So it's worthwhile you like trying lots of different things and working out if you're good at it, like how good you are versus other people, and whether you enjoy it. And I actually, before I made the jump to charity entrepreneurship, I was considering being a researcher. And the thing that stopped me from doing that was working on the project with Jamie Harris, who then became my later co-founder, and realizing how much better he was than me. So I was like, okay, this is what an actual researcher is like. And like, it's much better for people like them to be researchers than someone like me. So I need to find something else that I can do, like a really good level.
I can say Jamie's a great researcher. Also, you still have a great podcast, yeah. Sentience Institute podcast, another good one on animals, which we'll also link because there's some great episodes there.
James, are you saying I'm not a good researcher?
I've never seen your research, so I actually can't comment. Very diplomatic. How do you think you do those kind of small tests? You mentioned volunteering for someone is a way, but do you have any ideas of how else you can like test if you actually enjoy something and you're good at something?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess that there is the two ways you could just do like really small projects, like mini projects. So what I'm talking about here is like I did a market report in the UK for the Good Food Institute with Jamie. And that was like a test of research. And it was kind of taking some of the skills that I had from consulting when I was developing reports for organizations and seeing if that was kind of applicable and how good I was. And as I said, I think I don't think that my research was bad, but it was just not as good as his. And I thought, okay, the movement needs more of you and less like less of me. I should find my thing that I'm good at. And I think that people can very easily like do these small mini tests. And it doesn't always give you a proper flavor, but I think it can very quickly update you on whether you're right on like the right track or on the wrong track, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good like motto, kind of like how actually child entrepreneurship does its research. It's like iterative depth. So you'll do something for an hour, see if you like it, do something for 10 hours, see if you like it, and then you're gonna keep going. So rather than maybe I wanna be an investor, I should get a job investing, actually think, you know, maybe talk to someone a couple of times who's done that job. Maybe you try to do it on the side with your own money for like a couple of hours. So I guess that's the kind of idea, right? You kind of iteratively explore how much you like and how much you excel at something.
I think that's also a really good idea to speak to other people in the movement and ask them how they like, what does the actual job look like, to get a better understanding of it? Because I think a lot of people actually just don't do that. They just go straight into a job. And they try it out for like 2 or 3 years. And then they realize this isn't the job for me. So then they have to try and find another job to take the place of that. And that's 2 or 3 years that you basically wasted when you maybe could have just done like a much smaller test and saved your time and then spent the time like making an additional kind of career decision, I think.
Well, thanks for that, Lauren. That's a really interesting personal journey. I always really enjoy understanding how people came into the movement. I think it's always interesting maybe for listeners who think that their skill sets don't apply, I was in quite a similar position applying for my first kind of welfare movement job in corporate relations. I'd come from the property sector. I was like a disciplinary officer for students, thinking like, I have no like transferable skills. But then it turns out, you know, disciplining students about how they've been bad and corporate relations is actually pretty aligned. You know, I'm just like going into an intense environment and having to be the one to be the bearer of bad news. So yeah, it's always really interesting when there are ways in which actually you're just practicing those same skill sets that you can then put towards animals in some way. So let's get into animal advocacy careers then. I think another real plus from charity entrepreneurship is that you haven't had to come up with the idea yourself. You're kind of, all of those hours of research have gone into the actual intervention. So you're likely, it's likely to be, you know, a success with the right co-founders behind it. What is the kind of top line pitch for animal advocacy careers, and why initially did charity entrepreneurship assess that it was needed? And do you think that that is still the same reason that it's needed today?
It is hard for me to summarize what AAC does, but I will try. And I think that really we're trying to strengthen the movement by attracting and directing more talented, mission-aligned people into the movement who wouldn't have got into the movement without AAC. I hope that kind of answers that part. And then, yeah, I guess when the research that charity entrepreneurship did was that actually they think it would be beneficial for somebody to be working on something, something that could basically help talented people come into the movement. And I think that like our first job actually was to start doing more research into that. So one of the first things I did was interview 12 executive directors who were top ACE recommended charities and ask them a series of questions, just trying to like really do a needs assessment basically of what it was that was the problem, and how if talent really was a bottleneck, or if it was funding, or if it was something else. And if it was talent, what kind of talent specifically was it that was missing? So I think that basically the research was then the impetus of how we would move forward. But I think their general idea was that there should be some sort of capacity building organization that really was focused on talent. And they advised us to experiment in different ways in which we could bring people into the movement, which is how we started off basically.
I guess there was at least context from like the effective altruism community that 80,000 hours had already been running for quite a few years, had done kind of programs that you might be considering. So there was some precedent for similar work. But I'm also wondering, what are like the main programs you guys offer now? And yeah, what was like the testing approach that led you to decide on these programs?
It's always actually very difficult to, harder than we knew at the time, to test different programs for AAC. And part of the reason for that is a huge lag effect between people taking the program and making a career shift. So some of the programs now that we are running, we only really found out that they were cost effective in the second year. So we just had like some kind of like earlier indicators, like lead indicators that they seem to be slightly more cost effective than the other ones. But the first three that we tried was management and leadership training, because management and leadership was a huge skill bottleneck in the animal advocacy movement, our online course and career advising. We've carried on with the online course and the career advising. And then actually we just did the job board because it was part of our recruitment, our next program recruitment. And it's turned out to be one of the best programs. And it was also the one that everyone wanted us to do. So I think sometimes also you kind of just have to go with how things are evolving. And for us in particular, the job board was one of those things that really kind of, it actually came more from funders. They were like, we'd really like you to do a job board. And we were like, okay, well, that does kind of fit in with our recruitment anyway. And it's turned out to be one of our best programs. So that was interesting thing on our side.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting whole difficult challenge you have in measuring your impact, because yeah, I think now you have a fairly sophisticated tool that we don't have to dive into just yet or at all. Maybe it's a bit dry for the podcast, but I mean, it is hard to actually measure the effects you're having on people if you're offering a training now, or they're doing the online course, or they see a job board and they take the job a year, 2 years later, and what percentage of that was you versus their friend and everything else. So I can imagine that's a whole complex issue. And to clarify, the programs you guys are offering now, it's the job board, the online course, and career rising course. So it's those three things, right?
Those three things are our main programs. We have another project, but it's kind of in pilot mode. And I would rather like say that those are three like programs that I feel quite confident that we will carry on with in the near future.
Just to clarify, from the management training previously, that was to get people who were maybe mid to senior level, or is that training for managers to be able to recruit?
It was, I guess, just a different way of looking at how do we fix the skill bottleneck. So one would be just bringing more people in, and the other was like, how do you get people who don't have that skill to be more skilled? So that was kind of the idea of like people who were in the movement who were either wanting to be managers or just didn't have much management experience to do that management and leadership training. And I do think that it actually was relatively successful. It's just really hard to compare how much value that's bringing to just slightly upskill somebody versus bringing someone completely in from outside of us. And I think the thing that really made us not want to carry on with that is the fact that neither Jamie nor myself had that kind of experience. And I think now there is other organizations like Scarlet Spark that offer that, where Tanya just has like huge amounts of management and leadership experience. And I think that's, again, getting back to like the comparative advantage aspect of like what AAC does. And I think that there are people that are better suited to doing that kind of thing than AAC.
You spoke about AAC bringing kind of mission aligned people across. I'm always interested to know kind of how important that is in terms of actually bringing across the skill set, but perhaps they're not vegan, perhaps they've never cared about animals in the past, but you know, they're really good at their job. And I've always wondered, are we missing out on an opportunity here where, you know, someone with a great skill set that we don't have in the movement could come across and work in here? You know, in the corporate sector, it's the same. You could be working at a job and like, you don't agree with, you know, necessarily what you're doing. Obviously, I don't think it would be to that extent. But in what way do you think it's important that everybody you're bringing in is 100% mission aligned?
So that is a really good question and something I think I've actually updated on. So I think that at first I thought maybe it was less important that people are like mission aligned or vegan. Because they're already working in our movement. So if they're willing to do that, then they must be slightly mission aligned. But I do actually think that it is a really core part of what makes up the best candidate. So I think the candidate needs to be really skilled, but they definitely need to have the right attitude, which I think is slightly different to mission alignment. And I think if that person doesn't have that right attitude, it means that like, I think it can cause rifts in the team, but I also think that it means that they might make different decisions to the one that you would actually make. And I think when you have a team that you really trust, that you know is super aligned with you, that you can trust that they would make those decisions without you. And so it might lead to these very negative leadership styles where you're micromanaging people because you don't trust the decisions they're making. And I think that really actually value alignment is a huge core component of making up the best candidates.
I'll just come back to that. I wonder if then, because sometimes I think as well that the movement is, we're so mission aligned and really led by the heart that perhaps we don't always make the most pragmatic decisions. So do you always think it's an issue, like you're saying, they might make a different decision to you, but actually I think that could be a positive because they could just be looking at it from a pure business perspective. You know, how do we just get to the end goal quicker? And maybe that's more useful than us all like, no, we want everyone to change and be vegan for the animals. You know, sometimes it's like non-negotiable that unless we're convincing the whole population to be vegan for the animals, we haven't done our job properly. Well, what if someone came in and was like, do you know what? To end this, it's going to have to be the health angle. We're going to have to put animals to the side, ignore all the terrible footage and just really ram down the health angle. And that's going to bring us the end. Do you think that that is something to consider, or do you think that shifts us too far where, again, those rifts become like irreparable and the movement kind of collapses overall?
I think what you've touched on there is like how important it is to have diversity in a team, which it absolutely is. Like you want people that have different experience. You want people that have a different way of thinking. But I think that you all have to agree that the priority is ending factory farming. You don't want someone whose priority it is to end factory farming and someone's is to like maximize profits or to do something else, because then I think that you're going in two different directions. So I do think that having like a diverse team is really important, but I think underlying that diversity, there has to definitely be this like core agreement on alignment and an attitude to like being conscientious or other things that maybe organizations want to hire for. I think that both are really important, but I can agree with your point there that we definitely don't want to just kind of hire the same types of people into all of our roles.
I'm curious what you mean by like good attitude, like in that context. What does that mean besides value alignment or you care about the same end goal?
When I think about my team and I think like what I mean by good attitude is that I want my team to be hardworking. I want them to be the kind of person that doesn't just drop their work if it isn't finished and go on holiday. I want them to like really feel that the kind of attitude that I have, the attitude that like we really want to do this for animals, and it is okay to take care of yourself, but you also are a conscientious person that really cares about what you're doing. And I think sometimes that there is the potential, and I think this is a risk, that people come into a role and they do it just for a paycheck. It's not very common in the animal advocacy movement because we're not super well paid, but I do think that sometimes people see it as just our job. And like right now, I think our movement is so small that I think we can at least have that bar where it's like the people that are in the movement really care about what we're trying to do. And so they have that attitude of being like really hardworking, and are going to make that decision that's also the best for the organization, but the best for the movement as well. And they're not just kind of thinking about it from their own like perspectives.
And so what's been your recorded impact to date? Is there kind of a figure that you have of how many people you've placed in the movement? How are you measuring those, albeit difficult to measure, programs?
Since starting, we have tracked around 85 people who have engaged with our services and have subsequently changed jobs. And we have about 8 pending interviews. So it could be potentially more than 85, but 85 is the number that we kind of go for. And then how we actually track our impact is slightly different. So each one of our programs has specific lead indicators that we kind of head towards. And when we achieve those, we're really happy.
Can you share some examples of like a lead indicator for one of those programs?
Yeah, sure. So for our online course, it's how many people have signed up to our online course, which I think is quite a common metric, but we also like how many people have completed our course and have also scored more than 90 points, I think, on the quiz that we have at the end. So that's the kind of like breakdown of the metrics that we have for our online course. All of those programs have their own specific lead indicators. And then at the end of that, it's how many people have like kind of interacted with those services and changed jobs. And then we interview those people who have that we've seen have actually changed jobs and have interacted with our services. And at the interview stage, we're really trying to work out more about their role. So to understand like what they actually do in their role. And the idea here is to try and get at the value of like if it's the hardest to hire for role or if it's just a role that organizations probably would have been able to fill for otherwise. And then we also ask them questions on how likely they were to enter the movement if it wasn't for animal advocacy careers in the next 5 years. And that's really how we end up measuring our impact is the number of placements versus the answers to all those questions and then what's left at the very end, which we think is our impact, basically.
And do you have a really, really sexy name for this metric?
Yes, it's the important and counterfactually adjusted placements. But we call it ICAPS. And I think most people don't really care for understanding how we make ICAPS, and I think they don't need to, but it's basically just how we really just try and make sure that the impact that we're having, or try as hard as we can to see like the impact that we specifically are having on the movement that wouldn't have without AAC.
I think it's great. It's always been one of the organizations, I think, where so easily you could just be looking at job board hits or, you know, yes, people, obviously we're needed, you know, everyone says that we're needed and that be your metric, but actually you want to go much deeper than that. You want to understand the impact and really tracking those candidates. I think, yeah, probably as an organization that is very meta, that sits outside of the actual implementation of a lot of this action. I think it's, yeah, one of the organizations where you're really looking into that detail, and something that I think a lot of other organizations could be doing more of, to not just assume that because it's something that everybody wants and is needed, that means it's successful. There's other metrics in there that you could be using to just ensure that it is having its desired effect.
Thanks, Amy. I really appreciate that. I do have some concerns about it, that like partially it's quite subjective. So one thing that we're trying to do this year is to standardize the scores that we have, so that it has like less room for subjectivity and is more standardized. But also sometimes I do worry because of the lag effect of our program. So that's like if somebody took the online course or was career advised by me today, that they might not change their roles for 2 or 3 years. And as we're bringing in new programs, it's really hard for those programs to compete on ICAP level within like the first 1 or 2 years. So I think sometimes like measurement can be really tricky and it can be difficult because we're just not really sure whether, how to compare new programs versus old ones. And then we end up with just like cutoff points, basically, of whether this program seems like it could possibly hit the ICAT bar that the other ones that we know are doing.
And do you think funders are open to that sense of needing a bit more of a runway to understand the programs? Do you think you've been given enough leeway to fully assess that?
For the first 2 years, we only really had one funder. And I think they were really behind this idea of experimentation. So we were extremely lucky with that. I think the other funders that we have had since really are looking at results. So I don't think they are as keen with this kind of experimentation, which is really sad, actually, because I think we need more of it, not just from AAC, but also with like other organizations and their recruitment processes. They really do seem to be like quite heavily, okay, how many people have actually like changed jobs because of this, though? And it's interesting because I was actually speaking to 80,000 Hours today, and they actually seem to have the opposite problem. They were specifically telling me that they tell their funders the lead metrics, and they don't care about their dippies, which is what they have. And I was like, I really wish that our funders were the same. I wish that they were just happy with our lead metrics. And then they weren't so like, yeah, really wanting us to have those results. And I'm not really sure why the difference is. It could be that 80,000 Hours is just much better established than AAC. But for sure, that was really interesting coming from another organization telling me that like, hey, Lauren, you need to worry about the results less and like be more worried about like the lead indicators increasing over time.
Yeah, I guess I wonder if this is ATK has been around for so much longer. And I think they did quite a lot of experimentation early on. I think I remember reading in a while ago one of their reports saying they actually thought it was a concern that they had like four or five main programs quite early on and they kind of drop things over time. But then, yeah, I guess it's easier to compare things one-to-one when it's all kind of going simultaneously rather than kind of dropping things and picking up things and things a bit more staggered. But yeah, I don't know either why there's a difference in like funder interest in those metrics.
Yeah, I think also one thing that they were saying was that a lot of other surveys reference 80,000 Hours and how important they've been for career changes. And AAC is just not at that point yet where other surveys are saying, hey, 20% of our candidates have come from AAC. And I think if that becomes the point and we're kind of like self-evident and it's ourselves, then we can maybe relax a little bit on that and maybe do like more longer term measurement. But I think at the moment, we're really not like that. And through doing this kind of rigorous monitoring that we do, we can see that some of our services are just orders of magnitude more impactful than other ones. And that's very reassuring that at least we're kind of like going in the right direction.
Let's move on to the kind of state of the entire movement then. Not that I'm resting that on your shoulders to resolve, Lauren, but it's going to be good as someone who is really heavily involved and obviously speaking to movement leaders all the time to understand what you believe to be the biggest talent bottlenecks right now.
So I want to firstly caveat that we are updating our research this year on the talent bottleneck. So the answer that I'm giving right now is based on our 2021 skill bottleneck survey and also just from working directly with organizations for their recruitment. And that survey said that the hardest to hire for roles are in policy and legal, in fundraising and in leadership. And I think that working directly with organizations and also just like through the job board yourself, you can really see those are the roles that are extremely difficult to hire for. And the evidence from that is just the roles going back on the job board or leaders reaching out like, hey, Lauren, have you got any good candidates? Because we really need them. And those tend to be the ones. I to date, have not had any organization coming to me going, hi, Lauren, have you got any good candidates for our like more junior roles? So I think it's more the more senior roles in those like particular skill bottlenecks that really kind of come through the most. But one additional thing that I have noticed, at least in Europe, is campaigning roles. And I'm sure, Amy, you know about this, but I really believe that many organizations are really struggling to get good campaigners into their roles. And that's more like directly working with those organizations and less based on the research. But hopefully the research this year will show that is the case as well.
Can you speak specifically to those categories and assess or give your even personal opinion on why you think it is specifically for those?
Well, I think in general, as a movement, we're not really investing enough in a pipeline of talent. So I think that people are really just expecting people to just turn up out of nowhere. And I think that is like a really large problem. But I think also we're not having enough people going out and getting experience and coming back in. So for example, in policy, I think that for a lot of the policy roles, they want people to have gone into government or have worked for an MP or to have that specific experience and understand the mechanisms of policy and to come back out with that experience and be a lobbyist. And I think as a movement, we're just not really old enough for that. And people haven't thought about working outside of the movement and coming back in. So for things like that, I can really understand that we just need to kind of go back out and come back in. And then I think with fundraising, it was also on another survey that we did, it's the highest turnover rate for fundraisers. So I think fundraisers are also burning out. So as I think we struggle to get them in, and then we struggle even more to like retain them,
to keep them.
So it's like this constant thing that's going on. And I think when people are talking about fundraising specifically, they're really talking about major donor fundraising. That's the kind of key skill bottleneck. And I just don't think there's like really much experience that people can have in this. And I think that's it's a missing part. Like, I think more organizations should pay people to become like junior major donor developments, like who have the skill set to become good fundraisers, introduce them to the donors so they can understand like their organization, they can understand how to fundraise, and that we can like build up a pipeline of major donor fundraisers. Because, I just don't know how else we're going to do it, to be honest, because it's not just having fundraising experience that people want them to be connected to the major donors in our movement or in a movement that connects well to our movement.
Yeah, I mean, that is a pretty niche skill. I think major donor fundraising is like, you know, you don't go to university and you learn about major donor fundraising. You don't do it really in like a class. So I can imagine that's an extremely hard thing to get experience in, or like to have a pipeline for. So yeah, I can imagine that's particularly tough.
In terms of the skill set for that, then at the baseline, it's talking to people, right? Convincing them of a good idea, saying, you know, convincing them to hand over that money. What do you think is the kind of, or do you have an opinion on the greatest sort of skill set for that type of role?
So we do have a fundraising skill profile on our website, Amy, that will tell you all the answers to that. But as far as like, we also did
fundraising. And we'll link it below so people can read it as well if they want to.
We also did a fundraising work placement program, which was really specifically focused on bringing people outside that had those kind of skills for fundraising and placing them in an internship in organizations. And like 50% of those people are now working in fundraising roles in the movement. So I think it is possible that people have these kind of transferable skills. And the skills that we were looking for were slightly broader because it wasn't just major donor fundraising. It was more fundraising in general. But I think it's people that, have good personal skills. If it's grant writing, they need to be able to write compelling arguments. They need to be able to like story tell, have like good people skills, maybe do a bit of research as well, because I think it's really helpful to be able to research the donor and understand what their interests are so you can have a really good conversation with them. I think off the top of my head, those are some things, but they're not like really specific skills. I think a lot of people could have these skills. I think we just need to also create space in the movement for these people to grow and be connected to organizations' missions and their donors so they can form those relationships and then be the future kind of like major donor fundraising talent pipeline.
Do you have any thoughts on what a good talent pipeline looks like, maybe from other movements or issues, maybe for something like policy and legal or campaigning, and how we can improve ours?
Yes, I think when we had a recruiter working from us, it was actually her idea that we should do a work placement program. And I think that she said it's just really common, particularly when they don't exist at all, the skills. You need to start building those skills up and you need to give them opportunities to like work in the movement. So that's what we did with our fundraising work placement program. I think quite a lot of organizations are cottoning onto this. They do paid internships, not always specifically to skill bottlenecks, which I think would be really useful. But there are more paid internships. And I think that is like just a really good way to upskill people on the specific skill sets that we want in our movement. So I think the options are either to do that or to get people who have like those transferable skills and bring them directly into our movement.
I ask because this is very relevant to something I'm working on at work, which is how do we get more people working in political roles, maybe potentially in the US. But I mean, some ideas we have are, just basically how do we get more people who are mission-driven, working in government, working for, in this case, people who work in Congress, senators, and people representatives. And and I think some ideas we have is, funneling students, particularly kind of like third, fourth year people to get congressional internships get some experience, be a staffer for a bit, see how that goes, and then just actually getting, helping them get their foot at the door, whether that's support with hiring. Not exactly sure, I'm still fleshing this out. So actually, give any thoughts on the political pipeline, especially? Very useful to hear.
Yes, we also have a policy skill profile, which I'm sure you can link at the bottom. So I think I can only really talk to my knowledge is in UK and Germany. And I think it really kind of depends on what they specifically want to do. If they want to go and work for an MP, they probably already need to be volunteering in that group. So if it's like in England, if it was Labour or Conservative, if you wanted to work for a Conservative MP, then you need to already be working for the working group, the Conservative working group, and like showing your party allegiance. So I think that's something that they look for as like an indicator, and then like grow up to. But I think a lot of it, James, is just network as well. So I think that the more
that
they can get involved in like that kind of volunteering in that kind of party, I think is they're more likely to be networking with people. They'll be well known. And then often, like I know some people actually work on MPs who are trying to get elected. So they do the campaigning for the MP and then the MP gets elected and they remember that person and they want to bring them on onto their staff. So I think placing people in all these different types of things hopefully will then eventually lead to some of them getting a position. But I think a lot of it is to do with network.
And maybe my last one before I move on the pipeline thing is I think probably one reason why things are like weakened relative to like maybe some years ago is there used to be lots of university campaigns at universities, like particularly in the US. I think groups like Rescue for Animals and the Humane League had like fellowship programs where they'd have kind of fellows who are doing kind of campaigning on the campus and doing advocacy, and at least in this case, getting trained up in campaigning. And that meant there was a pretty good number of people who had campaigning skills because they'd done their local university K3 campaign, the Meatless Mondays campaign, and they would slot quite nicely into jobs. But I think now we don't have as good university kind of campaigning infrastructure. So I wonder if there's a bit of a gap in the market there to train up students. I guess in the UK, there's plant-based university. So I think there's no way better to get experience at actually doing something like you said before.
I think, Amy, you probably know more about the campaigning kind of bottleneck than I do. As I said, it's like, because it's not been something that we have evidence to back, it's not something that we've looked into specifically enough yet, but maybe you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. One challenge I see and hear from, you know, campaigners who were in the movement, who've, you know, maybe burnt out or moved to a different place, is also a sad kind of lack of autonomy and creativity right now. I think as a movement, as we grow and professionalize, and that's awesome, you know, we're bringing so much more money through to help animals. But what that means is that the movement becomes quite homogenous, and a lot of the times where, oh, that one thing was really successful, so let's all just do that all of the time. And it sort of just really takes out what that core campaigning role, the people that are passionate about that campaigning role, come into the movement for, which I think is that like raw idea generation, thinking of a mad idea that just gets attention. And, you know, the sort of old school days of the movement where you just, you know, in your team, you're coming up with awesome ideas that then get press. And it's kind of a challenge, perhaps, of us being more EA aligned, kind of worrying about measurements. I think similarly to a lot of the challenges you face, Lauren, I think in campaigning, it takes a while to understand what's been successful and what hasn't, and what's kind of changing perceptions and what's having that impact. And without that kind of core sense of creativity and really coming up with something new, I think the roles are just less exciting for campaigners now, because it's like, here's this carbon copy of thing that everybody else does. Do that, please, in your job. And actually, here's five members of staff that you need to manage. And so actually, those real creatives in the movement are spending so much time on the bureaucratic workings of organizations, one-to-ones with their staff, that actually so little time is just spent on coming up with ideas and really, you know, really pushing campaigning forward. So I think that's a real challenge right now, certainly from what I'm hearing.
That's a shame. So you think that the kind of similar thing for us, like you need a funder that's like okay with you experimenting, basically, as opposed to being very, very, very results oriented.
Definitely.
So James, really, it's the funders.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, come on, James.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who's doing that. I don't know. It's definitely not me. Anyway.
I think there's also kind of an interesting quality that we've perhaps lost in the, you know, we've professionalized, we've gone from really kind of scrappy grassroots, and from a sustainability and development perspective, advancing in a lot of those areas is really positive. But actually, perhaps in the image and the kind of the look and feel of how the movement operates, we've maybe just lost a little bit of that core sense of, you know, I'm going to write on a placard and I'm going to take that because I'm passionate about it and the people around me are passionate about it. And we've gone to corporate billboards of like, you know, everything's branded and really looks sharp. And I think sometimes it's quite sad that we've kind of lost some of that naivety from early on, where it's just the passion that's driving us and we're going with a great idea. And actually, we start to look a bit like the corporates that we've kind of merged so far, that actually it just looks like you've hired a load of people to go and stand outside McDonald's. It doesn't look like, you know, these people are... do you know what I mean? It's sort of like gone too far. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of challenge in that right now, I think.
I feel like there's a whole other episode in here.
Yeah, sorry.
I think, no, this is good. That was a good little bit. I've never really thought about that in that much depth. So thank you, Amy. This is a good, maybe this will be the seed of another episode. So
sure.
Yeah, I would certainly love to know more about it. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah. To get back to our conversation, Lauren, so I guess you kind of spoke about the few main bottlenecks, particularly as like policy and legal, fundraising, management, leadership, and potentially campaigning, but, you know, to be verified in your research. I guess, what is AAC doing about these bottlenecks? And yeah, how does that fit with your programs?
We did the fundraising work placement program once, so we really tried to specifically target that. But I think now we are looking into specific things that we can do to focus on building talent pipelines in a more cost-effective way than our fundraising work placement program. So one thing we want to do this year is to create like a legal specific series of, it's kind of like an online course, but just for legal, and to create a series of events. And the idea really behind that is to get people who have the legal and law skill set to be interested in animal advocacy. And so I think if that works well, and it's probably will be cheaper than it was for the fundraising work placement program, then that's something that we could try and replicate with all of our kind of skill bottlenecks. So to really like build up a much bigger, not just have like one skill profile, but have something much more in depth for each one of our skill bottlenecks. And that's one thing that we are thinking about doing. But I think that all of our work really is focused on this, like James, our metric is really for the hardest hire for role. So really everything we're trying to do is to get the most of those roles possible filled with AAC's work.
One thing I hear is that there's also a lack of diversity, particularly in maybe more leadership and management roles. Is that something you feel AAC is kind of equipped to address, or is that something that's in your bringing in of talent? Is it something that you think about?
I think it is a big problem. Part of it, I think, is in how people enter the movement. So I think that a lot of people enter through volunteering, and we need volunteering as a movement. I'm not suggesting that we don't need volunteering, but only a specific demographic of people can volunteer. And I think a lot of people start off as volunteers and then they end up moving up the ladder. And so a lot of people in leadership are also people who were like lucky or fortunate enough to be able to afford to volunteer. And another problem that we have is also in just the recruitment process itself. So a lot of people don't pay people at all throughout the recruitment process, and they're very long recruitment processes. So that can also just like, there's a lot of like small things that we're doing as a movement that I think really do prevent us from attracting more diverse people. And of course, the fact that our salaries are quite low also means that only a certain type of people can afford to work in the movement. So I'm not really sure if this is something that AAC can do, because I think it's a structural problem with the animal advocacy movement. But the thing that we try and do is be aware of them, share any information with people who are hiring when they're hiring, and try and promote other types of volunteering, like paid internships as well, so that, or like, even I don't know, you could do some sort of scholarship fund volunteering as well. So just like kind of making sure that there is entry points for people who aren't able to volunteer for free, I think would make a huge difference.
I think that's a really good point. And there's a question actually after Aaron's episode that I wished I'd asked. I was, you know, I'm listening back through the episode thinking, oh, I should have said that. And one thing that I wish I'd addressed that actually you've clarified was the challenge of longevity in the movement. And what that means is the same people who've been here all the time have kind of worked their way up and really hold those positions in those top tier jobs. And perhaps that's stifling more diverse talent coming in, because if we all are pro longevity, it's the same people that you see around, you know, a very kind of privileged demographic. And so maybe actually that's a challenge. But then what I'm hearing from you is that actually we have a management bottleneck there. So perhaps, you know, it's not a sense of those people holding that ground and staying there forever. So there's no way anyone can move up into management. From what I'm hearing from you, there is actually also jobs in that tier that new people could be coming in to fill, that, you know, are from more diverse backgrounds that could help the movement out in that way.
Vaughanalytics, I think, are going to do a study on this relatively soon again, a retention study. And just speaking, I think, to Brooke the other day, she was telling me that anecdotally she knows of at least like more than on her hand she can count of how many executive directors have left their role in the last 6 months, like to a year. So I think we're also getting a really high turnover of executive directors. So I think there are some people who have been here from the start, but more and more, there is definitely this kind of turnover of leadership, as well as in fundraising. But I think particularly in the last like year or so, there's something happening in leadership. And I don't know the answer to that before you ask. Maybe the study will kind of clarify it, but it's certainly like a pattern that we've observed.
Do you have any speculation on why that might be the case? Because I'm actually quite interested, because I don't think I've heard of that hypothesis.
I really don't. I guess that the movement seems to be more funding constrained than it was when I started AAC, because the very first thing that we did at AAC was ask organizations how much would like one donation trade off against a quality adjusted person. And a lot of organizations said quality adjusted person over donations. And I don't think that's the case anymore. Again, we're going to have to redo the study. But I think that in the last couple of years, like the funding in the movement has become like much more tight. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on the executive directors, because we are mostly the fundraisers. We don't have our like major donor fundraisers as well. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of weight on executive directors' shoulders. And I wonder if part of that is actually them just taking over that fundraising role. And the high turnover that we're seeing in fundraising is now on the executive directors, and that could be one of the reasons. But I am just speculating, and I look forward to the study, basically.
And is AAC doing anything on that management leadership kind of bottleneck, and how are you addressing that?
Basically, the answer is no. We're not specifically focused on management and leadership at the moment, but as with all the things that we're doing, they are like trying to also focus on finding managers and leaders. And actually, with our career advising service, a lot of the people who I advise in career advising are people who have the kind of experience to do something in leadership or those senior levels. And I think that's why career advising, even though it's much smaller in number than the online course or the job board, a lot of people who come to us for career advising who end up changing their career are going into those like more senior roles. But they tend to have a lot of uncertainties that they want to talk through. And I think that's why it's really helpful to have the career advising session, where we're just focused on like, what are your uncertainties, why you might be a really good fit, and like trying to find the right opportunity for them. So we have seen a lot of people get those senior roles through our career advising service.
And maybe just on that thread, moving on, if people do want career advising, how would they get that from you?
So currently, the way that people can get career advising is through a form, and we can add that at the end of the show notes, I guess.
One thing I wonder is with this kind of bringing new people in, and I think part of the challenge of the lack of diversity is you have identified, you know, non-paid test tasks, salaries being low. And a part of that issue of information capture is that you don't know who hasn't applied because of one of those barriers, right? It's sort of like you'll never hear from them. We'll never know that they didn't get that 50% of the way through the application process because of some barrier. Is there a way to find out who those people are and how to, you know, find out what was the reason that they didn't progress? And, you know, was it salary? Was it the big demand on the interview process? How do we sort of capture and understand why they haven't progressed in that process?
Yeah, I think that would be really difficult, I think, for an organization to do on an individual level. But we did actually do a survey about this time last year, because we were doing an inclusive hiring workshop in collaboration with Scarlet Spark. So we wanted to get organizations some data on the candidate kind of experience. And I think that there was like a lot of reasons, like, did you ever apply for a job and not follow through? What were the main reasons? And there's quite a lot of information on that survey that people can read, and we can again link to that in the show notes.
One kind of side that's just a personal bugbear of mine is not putting salaries on job ads, not being transparent about salaries. It really winds me up. Just like, let's just guess how much you're going to give me for this job and whether I can afford to apply. Like, who knows? How do you feel about that? And is it something AAC encourages?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Amy. I think actually, so part one thing that was really helpful about this survey was presenting the results back to the organizations and saying, like, this is how many people you're actually putting off by doing the strange things that you do sometimes, like not putting salary. And I think that I get really annoyed about this, because ultimately AAC wants to not just attract but also retain and nurture talent. And if the people that we're attracting are having a really bad experience when they're going through their recruitment process, they're going to leave the movement and they're never going to come back again. We spend a lot of money on attracting people in, so we want the organizations to look after them and like give them a good experience. And I think that this kind of like not putting salary on is really unfair, because people often actually only find out at the very end. So they might also have done a test task. They might already have done an interview, and they've spent like maybe, I don't know, up to 5 or 10 hours like of unpaid work going through a job that at the very end they find out I could never afford that. And I think that it's not very fair, and I don't think it's very good for the broader ecosystem of the animal advocacy movement. But I do understand why they do it, because they're like, oh, well, if we put the salary, maybe it'll put people off. But I think we need to be more transparent about these things. And I think ultimately it will lead to us having a stronger movement.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you.
Agreed. Yes. Also my personal, as a bugbear, okay, thing to say, my personal frustration is, yeah, it's just like, it makes me think the organization is like unserious. Like, you can't even share how much you're going to pay this job. It's like, anyway.
Thing we actually have on our job board now, people, if you don't put the salary in, we don't put the job on the job board.
Oh, great.
Nice.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Lauren.
That's good.
We are trying, Amy.
What are the other things that are top of the list in terms of really putting people off during the application process?
Yeah, there's quite a few things. I think a lot of organizations, and I do understand why they do this, they're really specific on the job description. So they're like, I am looking for a person that has this, and there are so many studies that show that people, like, especially like non-white men, look at the job description, and if they're not 100% fit for that job description, they don't apply. So by organizations doing that, we're putting off a load of people who might have been a really great fit for their organization. And so I think that having a really specific job description is not necessary, because the job, like the recruitment process itself, should filter people out. You don't need to filter people out in the application process. Just try and attract in as possible. So I think that's another really common mistake that people make, and just being too specific about their job descriptions.
I really love Charity Entrepreneurship's approach to that, and I've really updated my own exploration of careers based on that, is that they say let the process decide whether you're suitable or not, right? So at all costs, apply. You know, if the salary is right and that's displayed, then great, apply, and the process will whittle it down to who's included. Don't put yourself out of that role. Don't take yourself out of the race. The application process will do that for you. And I think that's great advice.
I really agree with that. And I think they get so many more people because they say something like that. So yeah, again, like having something like that attracts way more people to your job that you can then filter through by a good recruitment process. Other things might be something like the recruitment process being too long. So a lot of people will, like, they can't wait, especially if you're unemployed and you just need a job. And so you're like, I really hope it's the animal advocacy job. Like, that would be my top one job. But if you're unemployed and the process is 6 months long, are you just supposed to like be unemployed for 6 months waiting for the role? Or are you actually just going to have to get another job because you need another job? And I think that even if the recruitment process needs to be long, I think organizations could just be more transparent about how long the recruitment process is, so that people can then kind of self-select whether they can actually afford to spend that time doing the recruitment process again.
I saw that AAC recently launched this initiative, I think it was called Giving for Animals, where you're actually kind of inviting people who have the potential to work in high earning jobs or are working earning high earning jobs to use some of that income to help animals. I'm curious to hear more from you. I guess, what's the thought behind that initiative, and why do you think that's useful?
Yeah. Okay. So there's actually two different things here. One is like earning to give as a career path, and the other is the program that we're doing at the moment, which is effective giving. And I'll talk about each one. So the earning to give career path, I think, came from 80,000 hours. And I think that it's because, particularly as AAC grows, we're getting a huge amount of diversity of talented people who are coming to us and asking, like, how can I help as many animals as possible? And there are some people who could add significantly more value to the animal advocacy movement if they were to take those skills and earn $200,000, $300,000 a year and give 10% of their income. I mean, there are people who are earning that amount and giving 50% of their income. So like those kind of people can prop up a lot of small organizations. Wise, they might only be able to get a really like a junior or like average job in the animal advocacy movement. And I think that when we're giving people career advice, we really want to talk about like specifically for that person, how can that individual person add the most value for animals? And I think that earning to give can legitimately be one of the most impactful roles for certain people, under the caveats that person is okay with not working in the movement. And some people need to work in the movement. It is much harder to be surrounded by people who aren't mission aligned with you. And it can be like one of the main causes for people getting value drift. So I think there are a lot of caveats that we always add on the end of people doing the earning to give, but I think it is a legitimate career path for certain people who have a specific skill set that would really lend themselves to having a lot of impact for animals like that.
Some people just have unique skills that are better placed in the for-profit. And I think a really good example is to like very quantitatively minded, you love software engineering and you want to be a trader. There isn't any intense roles like that in animal movement, but there's plenty in hedge funds and as a quant trader. So I think that seems like one obvious fruit. And I think the other benefit is the obvious one is, you know, the nonprofit groups, like you kind of mentioned, are propped up by people donating money. So it's like, it's essential. And if we're going to keep kind of complaining or being like, oh, we're so short on money, then we're like, oh, people shouldn't go earn to give, they should work in the movement. There's a bit of a weird dynamic there where it's like, how do we expect to grow? And I think of one example being the effective altruist movements. They push earning to give very early on from like 2011. And now they have lots of money able to be used for good causes. So I think as like one kind of data point, I think they've done pretty well pushing this narrative. And obviously they've got some pushback, but I think overall a lot of good has been achieved using that kind of method.
I think we just have to be careful. So I think the thing that I think they also admit is a mistake is we don't want to push everyone out of the movement saying you go out there and earn money because that's the best way that you can help animals. I don't think that's true. I think it's really specific to the person. And if you want to talk about it, I'm really happy to have a career advising call with anyone who wants to consider the trade-off between earning to give or like having a role in the animal advocacy movement, because I think it's worth having a conversation about. And the other thing that you spoke about was our effective giving program that we're doing. And again, this kind of comes down to the fact that there's an interesting irony in the movement where there is actually a lot of people who are interested in working in the movement and not enough roles for all of those people. And so I think that for some of those people, if they're not able to get a role or if they're just like if they're in a job and they don't want to switch their career, another really easy way to help animals if they can afford to do it is to just give a certain percentage of their income to animals. And I think that this is something that we don't do enough of in the animal advocacy movement, and I'm not really sure why that is the case, but I really think that we could do to have more people giving a certain percentage of their income to help animals, because it would just really help diversify our funding and make us more sustainable.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're working with giving what we can, right, on that pledge. And the kind of standard one is 10%. I think, yeah, and I took the pledge end of 2022. Last year was my first full year. And yeah, I think it feels great to both be able to contribute to the movement. Like, it's not like an either or, you don't work in the movement or you donate. You can actually do both. And even if I sometimes think this, like if my work is going bad, you know, at the worst, my donations are doing good stuff, like guaranteed almost. So I feel good about that, almost no matter what. So I think, yeah, I think donating is a great way to help. Yeah, no matter what, basically.
Yeah. And I also think it's like an easier ask or entry point as well for some people. Not everyone, as I said, not everyone wants to change their career, but I think a lot of people could donate and then they could get involved in the animal advocacy movement and see their donations that way. So I wonder if like all of these things will kind of connect together and just basically bring more people in. But for the effective giving thing, it is more specific about like if you want to help animals and you haven't got a career yet, this is one thing that you can do that would derive a lot of value for us.
And how do you feel about the progression of the movement from that largely voluntary, everyone entering sort of grassroots level, doing some street activism, through to now the injection of money over the last few years? So people are largely in paid positions now. Do you find that that will or has had a significant impact on the movement in any way?
Yes, I think it's a really good question, a very interesting, and often people will talk about it. And I think volunteering is, as I said, a really important part of the animal advocacy movement. But for a lot of people, when they're volunteering, it's on side of their own job. So it's like a part-time specialization. And so for a lot of people who are volunteering, they're already working a 40-hour week or a 50-hour week, and then they're doing an additional 10 or 20 hours. And I think that that can really contribute to burnout in our movement. And I think that we don't have enough kind of things of this looking after our volunteers. And then when we look at how we're progressing now to more paid roles, then like that means that those people are spending those 40 hours just focused on animals. So if we have 80,000 hours of our career, if more people can spend 80,000 hours or a larger part of it on helping animals, I really think that this is going to be one of those things that accelerates our ability to end factory farming sooner. So I think both are really important. And I think that having that paid role is just building that capacity for more people being able to spend more time, focus and energy on helping animals.
And it is about the long haul. You only need to attend a conference and look around to see that, you know, most people in the movement, the majority of people still very young, still very early on in their careers, in those hours that they've racked up for the movement. Just having that sort of protection, feeling like it is a place that you can stay for the long term, I think has to be sort of exponentially impactful for the future and sustainability.
For people who didn't listen to the Aaron conversation, maybe there's some reference to there, because I guess the thing is, there's always a kind of like trade-offs. There's like, it's obviously good, but then Aaron was saying previously, the trade-offs are maybe people just take it more as a job. They just clock in, clock in, clock in, clock out, and they're less kind of like really driven, and I guess they feel somewhat less motivated, or like they're easier to like wind down and not think about work, which has benefits, but I guess it's has negatives as well. I think his point was, I think at least one quote is, everything has trade-offs, including this. Even though the overall might be better battles.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and I can understand why that might be the case. But I think most people who are getting a paid role in the animal advocacy movement, particularly because we do this like attitude checking and vetting, I think many organizations are either looking for you to have volunteered, so people have done that point. So it's not like they're just trying to get that really good salary because we're so well paid in the movement. Or they've been in the for-profit sector and they were earning like maybe two times or three times as much, and they're taking that salary cut to help animals. I don't think those are the kind of people that are just clocking in and clocking out. I think most people who are working in our sector really have at least had to demonstrate that kind of alignment when they're going through the organization's recruitment processes.
I agree. We're not going to solve this all today. So on that note, let's move on to the next section, which I think it hopefully nice and practical for people who are listening and interested in how to actually get a job in the space or how to enter the space. I guess maybe do you have any initial advice on people listening to the podcast, not currently involved in the animal advocacy movement? You've kind of shared some hints, but I guess what would you recommend as kind of three relatively easy things people to do who just want to get more involved or potentially find a job?
One thing that they can do is to do volunteering if they like to. I think it gives you a really good, nice flavor of what it's like to work in a movement. And I think it's also really motivating for people. If you want to know more about how the movement is and the kind of opportunities for you, you can take our online course. So I think this is a really good overview of the animal advocacy movement and the kind of career opportunities that are available for you. And you could also start off by doing a donation. So you could pledge a certain percentage of your money towards animals and see the direct effects already kind of coming in. So I guess that's something that people can start off as early as they want to, really.
And what about for those at maybe kind of university level? We've talked about different career paths. So, you know, if you have a particular leaning towards policy or legal or campaigning, but also that kind of earn to give arm as well. Do you think there's specific university courses or further education that really lines someone up in a really great position to eventually get a job in the animal movement. You know, we also we've had guests on talking about alternative proteins, so perhaps it's something, you know, like engineering or something. What do you think over the next kind of 5 to maybe 10 years those higher education pieces are going to be really integral into informing those positions?
I think it's much clearer for alt protein. So I think it's like they have very specific kind of skills that they need to, like, very technical related courses that people could get education on. I think it's much harder for the animal advocacy movement. For policy roles, it might be something like politics or economics or those kind of like adjacent things that would really help them to do that. But I think more generally, it would be better for people to just like focus on getting a degree that they're good at and that they enjoy, because then they'll get a good degree and they can kind of come out of that and then, you know, start experimenting in what type of roles they might want to try out with their career, and maybe do volunteering on the side, you know, so that you can also get an earlier flavor of what type of things that you enjoy doing in a working context.
If your university has one, joining your local kind of like animal rights group or whatever vegan group, just to get a sense of where there's campaigning, meeting people. I mean, that's how I kind of got involved in activism, I guess. Animal Quality was doing the VR headsets in my uni, and I was like, oh, this is cool. It's going to be fun. So things like
is
that.
It
also,
though?
Like,
that's well, what you thought. You put on the headset and you're like, yes, this
is
fun.
The headset isn't fun. When you see two macho guys come over acting all cool, put on the headset and leave like really quiet, you're like, that's right. Anyway, so yeah, university groups, if you have them, get involved. I think that's a good one. Also, I think something I didn't do enough, which I think maybe you agree, Lauren, is like using your summers for things like internships, if you can have them, or maybe the volunteering aspects, because university is a time when you have lots of time. So if you can use that to do that kind of activities, that seems, yeah, I think pretty useful.
Yeah, totally agree with that.
You mentioned before that maybe it's actually used for people to kind of not work in the movement directly after university and they kind of gain skills somewhere else. Do you think that is something you would recommend to people to kind of upskill in a different field or in like a for-profit world before moving into the animal movement?
I'm always very careful with this because I think that we don't want to push too many people out of the movement and for them to never come back. So I'm always really careful that I don't want to, without a good mechanism to look after the people who aren't working in the movement, to bring them back in and to keep them like in a community where they feel like they can like share their values with. I do feel it's like a bit of a strong statement to say that people need to go out to come back in. But at the same time, I do think that you can get a lot of really great experience from working in the for-profit sector, mostly just because like you get so much more access to things. Like the training that I received in the 7 years of working in the for-profit sector is unparalleled to anything that I've seen in our movement. You just get so many more resources. You're surrounded by other people that also have had a lot of experience in their particular areas. And I do think that for certain things, like maybe management and leadership, it could be useful for people to go out to the for-profit sector and then come back into the nonprofit sector. But I think it really depends on the individual and where they really want to go. But I would be really worried about saying that everyone needs to leave and come back in again. Because I think that we still need people that come out of university and go straight into a job in animal advocacy. And there are a lot of roles where you really need to learn in a role in animal advocacy, and it wouldn't be super beneficial, I don't think, to go into the for-profit space first and then come back.
For a context can be really useful, just knowing about the movement. I think over the years I've been involved has helped so much, just being able to know more people, background on the work and campaigns or whatever. So I think that's a huge boost. And I think the other one is this idea people may have heard of like golden handcuffs, like in consulting, it's quite popular. If you become a consultant, the money's really good. You go, I'll just stick with it for a few more years and I'll switch out. And then your lifestyle gets a bit nicer and more plush. And then your money goes up. And it's like a never ending treadmill. So I think there's also that risk of saying you'll go back to the nonprofit world, but you never really do. So I think that's a very valid point to make.
So what about people who want to further their career and take on those kind of more senior leadership roles? Perhaps they're already in the movement or at entry level coming in, but at a more senior role. Do you have any kind of specific recommendations for those candidates?
Really easy thing to do would just be like to read more about leadership in general. There's, I think, some really good books that are out there on leadership. And I think when you become a leader, it's really hard to find the time to read a book on leadership. So if you can do that in advance, that's then that's really helpful. I think also not everyone needs to be a leader or a manager. And I think that, again, doing these kind of like low cost experiments might be helpful, like taking on more management responsibilities, overseeing a team, see if you actually enjoy doing that. And if you do, then it's a good sign that maybe that's something. And you can also put that in your CV, like, I have management experience of running a team, because a lot of people will require, but to get a leadership role, that you have some like track record of being able to lead other people. So I think those would be like my main recommendations. There's also a lot of training out there on management and leadership. I haven't come across like one that I think is absolute gold management and leadership, but I think for sure there's some really good books out there on management and leadership stuff. And I think just taking on those responsibilities is probably a really good way to work out whether you're a good fit for it or not.
Lauren, what are those books that you'd recommend on management?
So I think Tanya Luna from Scarlet Spark has done some really good books, and also the Management Center as well has some really good resources, I think, for templates specifically for like how to run a good one-to-one. And I was recently doing a leadership training that was provided by Effective Altruism, and they gave a whole list actually of recommendations for leaders, and I'd be happy to share that Google Doc if I get some recommendation, if I get the okay from them. And the last one is actually a book that Layla recommended to me, and it's called No Rules Rules, the Netflix work culture, and really talks about the importance of having people that have the right attitude and skills in an organization in order to be able to, they call it talent density. And I think it's just a really good way of talking about like how we want things to be. Like, you need those people that you can really trust with your entire organization, because you'll just work much more efficiently and effective. So I also highly recommend that book that was recommended to me.
I also read that book recently. I also recommend No Rules Rules. Yeah, it's really good. And yeah, I think that the main thing is, if you work in an area that has like creativity or innovation at the heart of it, which I think campaigning does and some of our work does, and you want people who are willing to take risks, be innovative, and how do you create that culture? And yeah, there's lots of really good examples from Netflix, so I would also recommend that. And one of the one I've read a summary of, which I think Managing to Change the World, it's like nonprofit management focused. I think it's good. And there's even a really, there's like, it's a pretty short book. It's like the kind of book that's good because it can't be an article. It's just really dense and really practical. So I found it incredibly useful. So I would recommend it. And obviously being a bit more nonprofit focused is a bit nicer for people to actually get their grips around, get their head around. So yeah, I think it's quite good.
So just to round off and say thanks, Lauren, that's been incredibly insightful. Some closing questions. So one piece of news that you're grateful for or particularly excited about at the moment?
So actually it's on politics too, so you'll be excited. And I think there was recently in Germany, there was the new draft for the animal, I think it's called the Animal Welfare Bill or something like that. And a lot of it is heavily based on the Sentience Bill that came into the UK. And a lot of the things that they're recommending to do could have like a huge impact for animals, but it's also the first time that this legislation has been updated in 20 years. And a reason why I'm really particularly happy about it is one of the people that helped push this to be like really focused on by the government is somebody that we career advised into that position who was unlikely to be in that position otherwise.
Oh, so awesome. Like,
you really amazing. Can make a big difference if you do decide to kind of be in those positions. So I think that's really exciting. And I think that Germany is also considering a meat tax, which I feel could be really good if it's executed in the right way, and that it's on all animals, which I think is how it's considered at the moment. So I think Germany is in the political space, I think, is really putting some inroads into making some huge changes for animals that I'm particularly excited about.
We did a study on the meat tax at Animal Ask. So any other organizations interested in it, I would recommend reading that report, because it really has to be executed correctly, as you said, Lauren, to not avoid the small animal replacement problem. So yeah, we'll also link that meat tax report, but that's exciting. Yeah, really great. And to have placed that person, wow, I mean, that must account for a lot of AAC's impact to date.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know at the time. I don't think we were like, oh, this is only a small ICAP, but then... like years in, we're like, oh, actually, this is quite a good ICAP. Like, this person has actually done really meaningful things. So we might have to go back into our ICAPs and like adjust this person upwards based on helping put this in.
Do you have any recommendations for listeners on any of the topics we spoke about, whether it's books, podcasts, blog posts, so on and so forth?
The recommendations that I was most thinking about is Cal Newport's book, so good they can't ignore you. And I think that really talks about this passion versus kind of like being good at a trade-off in a lot more detail than I was able to explain today, and I think is really interesting on that. There's also another book called Range that talks about, I think the tagline is something like, why generalists trump specialists, which I think again is really apt for the animal advocacy space, because I think we do tend to be made up out of generalists, and I think it's a really interesting book for people to read. I would also recommend Mindset by Dr. Carol Dweck, and that is, I think, really a very useful way to frame things. Like, it even tries to help you to reframe rejection, to understand that, you know, it's fine to be rejected, and to really just, the way that you frame things is just so incredibly powerful. And I think can be really helpful for people when they're thinking about career knockbacks and setbacks, and how we can really take these things and have a more positive way and be more robust as a movement. So I think those are my three like kind of career related self-development recommendations.
That's great. I've not read any of those, so they're all added to my list as well. Thanks, Lauren.
And then for podcasts, obviously I would recommend this one. But then a kind of like really different podcast recommendation would be by Jack Cornfield, and it's called the Heart Wisdom Podcast, and it's basically a podcast that really goes, I think, the Dharma talks. So that a lot of them are just like recorded Dharma talks. I found it so helpful when I was in the consulting space to reconnect to myself by listening to this podcast, and I think that, you know, it's another kind of area that we didn't talk very much about like today, but in general, I think we really need to be looking after ourselves as a movement and spreading that loving kindness. So I think that that is a podcast that I just find keeps me grounded when things get really stressful, and is just generally really lovely to listen to. It has a very soothing, calming voice.
And so how can people get more involved in your work, Lauren? Obviously there's the job board, so they could be applying, there's the career consultation, but as animal advocacy careers, are you hiring at the moment? Do you need volunteers? Where can people find out more?
Yeah, so we're not currently hiring. For organizations, when we send the talent bottleneck survey around, I would really appreciate it if you would respond to the survey so we can have like a better understanding of the talent bottlenecks. For certain people who have actually engaged in our services, it would also be really great if when we want to interview, if people could respond to the interviews so that we can kind of work out like our actual impact. So those are like two things that we would really appreciate to help us be more impactful. But how people can get involved is most likely the online course. I really, really recommend that. Look out for, we're going to increase the number of blogs and like kind of career advising articles that we publish on AAC's website in the upcoming year. So hopefully some of those things will be really interesting for some people. And yeah, of course, please, if you feel like a career advising session would be helpful for you, then we are kind of reopening that form again, and we can link that to the show notes. And of course, lastly and not least, if you don't want to do a career, but you are considering just trying to have impact for animals, then I would really encourage people to look into the effective giving pledge that we are running with at the moment. Because again, I think that if we get a small number of people to even consider this kind of thing, we can prop up some smaller organizations and really improve the funding landscape for the movement.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Lauren. Great to chat. Really interesting area. I'm sure, many different people will have got a lot from this episode, whether you're in the movement, wanting to get in. I think that's been really comprehensive. So thanks so much for your time and everything you're doing for the movement. And best of luck with all of the projects going forward.
Thanks very much for having me.